I had a story to tell you guys. There was a guy who was drinking at a bar, shocker, and gets up to go home, and he falls down. Can't get up, so he just crawls out to his car. Gets out to his car, tries to stand up again, bam. Finally gets in his car, makes his way home, gets out, bam, hits the street, hits his driveway, crawls up to the door, tries to stand up, bam, finally gets the door open, crawls to the bedroom, tries to get in his bed, bam, he says, screw it, I'm sleeping on the floor. His wife comes home, kicks him, says, you've been out drinking again. He says, no, I haven't been out drinking at all. He says, you're a liar. Says, no, I haven't been out drinking. Says, you're a liar and I know it. Says, well, how do you know it? Said, the bartender called. You left your wheelchair again. Yeah. So there you go. All right. I'll be here all weekend. Tip your wait staff, right? So just soften it up to hit you with the hard stuff. This is the real deal. Because, if you ever really looked at the steps, really look at them. All my life, I believe the external is the problem. And the steps, only 5, 9, and 12 do we go outside. 5, 9, 12 is the only thing that takes us out. Everything else is done here. Turns us inside out. I'm thinking it's the outside I got to fix, and then internally I'll be all right. But here, what happens is steps a process of turning us inside out. We talked about the search for God. It's come to find out it's the last place we look. It's within. We find the power. We find this trust. So we do all this work, and it brings us to a spot where we got to get right with our fellows. Get right with God. Get right with self. Get right with our fellows. And everybody's got amends stories. Everybody. We could sit here and do the rest of the night about amends. We could just have story after story after story about amends. But I got the floor, so you get mine. Right? And so I think that when Bill Wilson talked about being rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, I think this is the spot where he talks about what happens us to get us propelled to that. This is the launching pad that propels us into the fourth dimension of existence. Prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and prior to making amends, I could tell you what your shoe color was, but not your eye color. Mm. When I would come outside, if I was downtown, I would look around the corner to see who was coming to tell me if it was all right to go or not. Because I don't know, I can't go if I might run into you. And so I'm always shucking and jiving around. When I was, some of you guys at the West Side Group the other night heard this story, but when at the height of my alcoholism, I had a law firm. I was a first name partner. I had 30 people that worked directly for me. I was, by the time I got kicked out of there, I was 37 years old. I got evicted from that building, 35, evicted from the building because I couldn't pay the rent anymore. I couldn't go to work. I couldn't show up. So I got evicted from that building. Much of my practice was in federal courts. People would cover for me. Federal judges, clerks would call me and say, where is he? Where is he? Oh, he's busy. We'll get somebody down there. People covered for me. All my life growing up with my mom and dad, I thought they're the bad guy. They're the reason I'm having problems. They're keeping me down. I'm not to get to experience life because of them. When I was in high school, I was small, and so they wouldn't let me play football. I love basketball, but vertically challenged. I love it. I was an eighth grader, and they put me on the seventh grade team. I'm so small. I got issues, man. I got issues. But this is the crazy thing. I became a bull rider because I'm from Oklahoma, which I should tell you that, and you should say, oh, well, he's qualified right now. We just know he's qualified because he's crazy. But I was a bull rider and I broke my neck in high school, and it ended really everything that I really cared about. It's when I had the deal with God that I really believed he had screwed me. Found one thing I was good at and took it away from me, where I was convinced God had screwed me. So when I get to my amends list, when I make the list and sit down with Don and go through it, I got some people I got to go see. It took me about a year and a half to get back to work. It was an old sobered up drunk lawyer and an old sober up bail bondsman. And they said, Cliff, you got to get back to the courthouse. And I was scared. I mean, I just didn't want to go. I mean, it was bad. If you get evicted, I mean, Oklahoma City's a relatively large sized community, but if you get evicted from a building in downtown Oklahoma City, people know. They know. I mean, it's not like an apartment building. And I had guilt and shame and remorse, and I didn't want to do all that. But my sponsor insisted that I probably should get back to work. And so, you know, I like what Bill Wilson says in his story. He said it was fortunate that most of my friends wouldn't take me back. It was fortunate for the first 18 months of my sobriety, I found a little work. Fortunate. When guys come to me and they talk to me about, you know, I don't know, I can't find a job. I take them to that part in the chapter and say, well, there's work for you to do here. There's other things for you to do. God's got other plans for you, and you need to take full advantage of that. And when I look at that, I'll think about how fortunate I was in those early years of sobriety. When I think about my first year of sobriety, and maybe you all do too when you reflect on it, that first year of sobriety, yeah, it was hard. Yeah, I wasn't working. You know, it was tough, but there was that time where I was going and doing AA. And I was forming that relationship with my sponsor. But not only doing that, I was doing what I think, and John and I talked about this the other night at dinner, I think, the second most important thing as a newcomer in AA. I was getting buddies in AA. I was making friends in AA, real friends. You know, I didn't have anything to offer them, and they didn't have anything to offer me. We learned about friendship, and we were huddled together trying to figure out, how do we stay sober one more day? And we would go do things together. We would hear about this guy talking over there. So we'd just all huddle up, four or five of us pile in a car, and we'd go over there. We just did sober things, and we learned how to be sober people. And I remember my wife, she was in Al-Anon, and what I call them, the icky kids, you know, the young kids, the icky paw people, the icky kids. They were doing the young people's conference, and my wife was like, when I got sober, I was 41. She was 32. She was the youngest person they knew in Al-Anon. So they put her on the icky committee as the Al-Anon liaison. And so those icky kids would go around and they would have events, you know, like they were going to go bowling, or they'd have a pancake deal, you know, something like game night at a clubhouse. And they would invite Lori and I, because she's on the committee, and I would tell Don, I don't want to go do that. I'm not going to go hang out with those icky kids. It's, how lame has my life gotten that I'm going bowling? I mean, I've reached a new level of lameness in my life, right? But I went. And I had a little girl who was, when I got sober, she was 11 years old. And I had a stepson who was 8 years old. And I took those, Lori and I would go and we would take those kids with us. And I would watch my kids. I would watch those icky kids interact with my kids, and I learned how to be a father. I mean, those kids taught me how to be a father. Watching them care for my kids without them even knowing, because I don't know how to be a father. I don't know how to do that. But I just watched them love my kids. And we would go do that. Before long, I'm taking two cars, because Lori says, I'm going home at midnight, and I'm staying. You know, I'm going to keep the kids and staying, because it became so important to me to stay and let those kids experience it. More importantly, I got to watch. And I watched those young people in AA teach me how to treat my own children, because I didn't know how to do that. And so I have to go down and make amends, because I get back to the courthouse and I'm doing the stuff I did when I was in law school. I'm going to the misdemeanor docket, right? I'm taking little cases. They would call me and say, hey, we got this lady, she's got this small claims case. I mean, it is the scrub of the lawsuit practice, you know. I mean, it is like what you send interns to do. I mean, I've tried multi-million-dollar lawsuits, and now I'm going to small claims for $1,500, you know, on like a $120 legal fee. But I'm grateful to do it because it got me back in the courthouse. And there came a time that, oddly enough, strange as this may seem to you people, that after a while I got sober, and guess what happened? I got busy. Come to find out, when I'm sober, I'm a decent lawyer. Who knew? Who knew? And I got busy again. I went to Don. I said, man, and I was out in the suburbs. I got banned to the suburbs. And I told Don, I said, man, I got to get downtown. I got to get back downtown. And there was this pause on the phone. I mean, just a pregnant pause. And he said, we got to think about that, which I knew what that meant. It was I wasn't going back downtown. And so I just resigned the fact that, hey, I'm just going to be driving back and forth every day. And it's not like it's a big deal, but it's not convenient for me, right? And about 2 months later, I'm having a call with Don. And he said, I want to talk about you going back downtown. I said, okay. He said, I think we can make that work. He said, the last time you went down there was a disaster. I mean, just a disaster. He says, so we got to do some things different. So this is what I'm thinking for you to do. He says, you can move back downtown Oklahoma City, but you have to be responsible for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day in downtown Oklahoma City, every work day. There wasn't a meeting in downtown Oklahoma City, nothing. And out of selfishness, because I want to get back downtown, I said yes. And he said, oh, and by the way, since you're going back downtown, I remember something about an eviction of a building downtown somewhere along the way. You need to go get right with those people. And so I said, okay. And so I called the building manager, who had changed by then, and said, told him who I was. And they go, oh, yeah, we know who you are. And I said, I'd like to come down and meet with you. And so I did. I set an appointment. I went down and meet with them and said, you know, a few years back, I ran into some trouble and I got evicted from this building. And I know I owe you some money. I'm not really sure how much it is. And pulled a drawer out and had a file. Apparently, they keep records of it. Pretty good about that, apparently. And she said, not to worry, I can tell you exactly what it is. And opened the file up and gave me the number. And I said, well, I'd like to make that right. I'd like to make that right. And I brought my checkbook and I wrote her a check. And I said, and by the way, since we're good here, he said, I need to move back downtown Oklahoma City. And I was wondering if I could come back here. And she said, Cliff, we'd love to have you here. We want to have you here. You're going to pay a little bigger deposit this time. But, we'd love to have you here. And I said, that's great. And she said, I'll have a lease ready for you next week. And I said, hey, yeah, one more thing. You know, I'm kind of like Columbo. Hey, one more question, one more thing. You know? I said, you know, I'm a member of a fellowship. And I said, you know, part of that's about getting right here, but I have some conditions on me coming back downtown. And I talked to her about what that was about. She said, you know, my husband's been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 29 years.
Wow.
And I said, well, look, I just need something small. I just need something. I don't know how much it'd be. She said, well, what are you thinking? So I kind of told her about what it. She said, there's a room on the same floor I'm going to put you in. Said it's just kind of an old shelled out space. It's got the wallpapers peeling and, you know, it was looks like a secretarial cubicle, really. And I said, it'll be perfect. It'll be perfect. And she said, well, I can give that to you. I said, no, I don't want you to give it to me. I said, you know, we pass a basket. We'll give you half the take every day. We get $2, you get one. She goes, that's fair enough. I said, okay, fair enough. So I moved downtown. We started this little meeting in downtown. Not because I think it'd be a good idea, because I'm selfish and self-centered. I need to get back down. It's convenient to me. It's convenient to me. And that little meeting began to grow. There's a couple of sober houses that got moved in and down by downtown Oklahoma City. And those women started coming to that meeting. It's all they had. They were most of them without licenses, so they could walk to that meeting. There was a big homeless population, and they found out about it. And about two or three of those guys and gals that were homeless began to come to our meeting looking for sobriety. I was in the heart. Was and have been, still am for the last 18 years. I practice law of the building I was evicted from. And it's in the heart of downtown Oklahoma City, where all the big hotels, my big concert, you know, with the big arenas and the big, you know, civic center, where all the musicians and plays come through. And it would not be odd to have some famous Broadway actor, some famous rock star, some famous sitting right next to a homeless person in that meeting. It became a very eclectic meeting, a very eclectic group, that at any given day you could find all kind of varieties of people in that group. And people were coming to that group and getting sober. They had a place to go. And I was about, I don't know, let's call it 8 years sober. And that little group had moved a couple of times. We had to kind of start to outgrow our space, our little closet. I remember one time I went to the building manager and said, listen, there's some other space, you know, just we have to walk through some space to get to our space. What if we went in and built that out? We'll put our own money in. She said, oh, I can't let you do that. We have insurance, all those problems, you know. She said, but I'll get our people to see what it would cost. And they came back with some ridiculous cost. So I met with their foreman on the job that came out. And she came out. She said, well, what are you doing? What are you doing with this space? I mean, all you want is a, you know, wall torn down. And so, what are you doing here? I said, what's an AA meeting? I said, we kind of grown down here. And she just looked at me. She said, I'm 13 years sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll get my guys to do it for cost. And we passed the basket and the money just came. And we built that out and people had a place to go. And it's about 8 years sober, and I'm coming to downtown Oklahoma City. It's raining. I got court. Of course, I'm running late because all this traffic. It's traffic. Because, like, you got George Bush and all these fancy smancy people coming down looting some big deal at the Myriad. It's raining. I'm delayed. I mean, they're delaying me. I got stuff to do. And I start judging and cursing and all these people. They're paying $5,000 tickets for a bunch of yahoos come down here making me late for court. My people, you know. I get all that done, get to court, everything's good. I come back, I go to the AA meeting. And in the AA meeting, there's a gal there. And next to her, and we had some of those sober women had little kids that they'd bring from time to time. And Don had me go get puzzles and coloring books, crayons. So when those kids came, they'd have something to do. They would be occupied so their mom could pay attention during the meeting. They wouldn't be distracted. And I'm there fuming, and, you know, I'm in my head. I'm thinking, I'm still at 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, I ain't left there. I'm still mad at the people down there going to see the bushes is what I'm mad at still, you know, for $5,000, and they're holding me up today. And so I go into the meeting, and I notice the lady there's been coming, and there's a little boy, and he's colored. He's down on his knees, and he's got the coloring book on the chair in front of him. And he's calling. And the meeting opens, they go around, and about halfway through the meeting, they call on this gal, and I'm distracted because I'm still at the Myriad. I'm still at the people down there. Still mad because I'm inconvenienced. $5,000 to go see these schmucks. Homeless people, for God's sakes, you know? And they call her, she begins to share. For some reason, I listen. I just listen. She said, you know, 2 years ago, I was sitting in a jail cell in Oklahoma County, and a social worker came to when I was in jail and came to see me. And she said, I just want you to know that it's going to be my last mission, that you never get to see that little boy ever again. Said, you're a drunk and a dope addict, and he deserves better, and I'm going to make it my last mission. You never see him. She said, I was crushed. She said, I went to Mabel Bassett's where I got sentenced to, and she said, there were some ladies from Alcoholics Anonymous that started bringing a meeting in. And she said, I went to that meeting, and I heard something different. And I asked one of those ladies to help me, to be my sponsor. And I began to do the things she asked, and I was on a 3-year sentence, and a year and a half, I got paroled out. And I got paroled out, and I went to this halfway house, and I started doing everything DHS had asked me to do. I started catching up on everything that they had asked me to do, that the social workers asked me to do, everything they asked me to do. And she said, in the last week at court, I got this boy back. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, for $2, I got that gift. I didn't have to pay $5,000. For $2 in the basket, I got that gift. I got to see Alcoholics Anonymous at its finest. I got to see what we do at our finest. Because you know the truth, man, when we're with each other, we are at our best. We're at our best here. And I got a whole new perspective again. A whole nother shift in my perspective about what we do here and how important it is what we do here. I had to go to those federal judges. I don't know if anybody's been in federal court before. Some of you might have been. Most of you just traffic tickets, but a couple of you. Might have had some brushes, you know, with some baby. Federal court, you just don't call them up and say, hey, I'm on my way over. They got those receptionists that are nosy. Like, why are you coming? And they park a federal marshal outside. Always. Always a federal marshal in the office. And so I started calling these judges and setting up appointments. And I would just say to them, listen, it's a personal thing. I just need to come see the judge. 6 federal judges in Oklahoma City, 6 in Tulsa, 2 in Okmulgee, all of them. So I just started having to make the rounds. And I would go in and they would just say to me, Cliff, what is it that I can do for you? And I just had to lay it out. And I had to tell them the truth that, look, I've been in direct contempt of your court. I'm laying out what my problem is. And I know that any minute they can pick up the phone and say, Marshall, just come in here. I need you to take him over to federal detention until we figure out what we're going to do with him. I'm getting ready to lay it out because that's what Don told me to do. He said, you just go in there and tell the truth. Let God work out whatever happens. And I'm going to tell you, to a person, every one of those judges would look at me and say, Cliff, all we ever wanted here was for you to be okay. All we ever wanted for you to be okay. And what they did, every one of them, still to this day, they said, here's my personal cell phone number. If there's ever anything you need, don't hesitate to call us. And I'm going to tell you, over the last, you know, I was about 8 years sober when that happened. So over the last 14 years, I can tell you, there's times I've looked at my phone and it would be one of those judges calling me, saying this, Cliff, there was somebody in my courtroom today. I think you might be able to help. I think there might be somebody here that you might can talk to. And it's been my privilege over the last few years to be available to those people, to those judges, and be of service to them in a whole different way that I wasn't even imagining. What I wanted to do was just to get straight. You know, it's like you take a rock and you throw it in the water, and there's a ripple effect from that.
That's right.
It's the ripple effect in Alcoholics Anonymous that we do here. We throw the pebble in and it goes out. And when I was about 3 months sober, I got a call from the Bar Association, from the bar executive director, and said, hey, Cliff, I hear you're doing better now. You know, we have this deal called Lawyers Helping Lawyers. Would you be willing to serve on that committee? And no, I don't want to do that at all. I didn't say that, but that's what I'm thinking. No, I don't want to do that at all. I don't even like you people, right? I don't like them. I mean, you know how the deal is, because I'm so selfish and self-centered, and I feel so insecure about my life. You know, the deal is that I talk bad about those people. That's just politics out there. Thank you. That's just politics out there. You know, they think I'm some yahoo from the country. You know, it's my reality, but it's all BS. It's none of it's real. None of it's real. But I talk bad about them. My own profession, I talk bad about them. And so I went to Don. I said, hey, listen, I got this call today, and it's, you know, they want me to be on this committee, but, you know, I'm only 3 months sober. He says, I think that'd be a great idea. Because he's an asshole. You know, he said, I think that'd be a great idea. Yeah. He said, because you owe. You owe. He said, those people have provided you a way to make a living. You owe. You need to go do that. I don't know what that's going to look like, but you need to go do that. So I had to call that guy back and go, geez, I'd be really grateful to serve on that committee, you know. And so for the last 22 years, I've served on that committee. And, you know, they would try to make me chairman. I said, no, I don't do that. I just want to be a worker bee. I'm just ready to feel called. I don't need to do all that. I don't need to, don't give me no title. I don't want to, you know, I'll suddenly think I'm running the Bar Association something. I don't need to do that. And, but they would call me like every year, new president come in. Hey, would you be willing to? And I'd go, no, I'm really better being just a worker bee. I'm a worker among workers, man. You know, I give them the party line. I'm just a worker among workers. I'm really grateful, but thank you. No, I'm okay. And then one guy called me and said, Cliff, no, really, I need you to do this for me. So I called Don. I said, man, he said he needed me to. He said, okay, will you call him back and say you'd be willing to do that? Like, well, I don't want to do that. He said, just do that. Okay. And so I did that. And for a couple, 3 years, I chaired that committee. Right after COVID, when everybody started kind of get back together in Oklahoma City or around the state of Oklahoma, we started having the bar convention coming back together. There was a guy from down in southern Oklahoma. This time had become president of the Bar Association. And during the bar convention, I always go and work our booth. You know, not many people stop by. You know, they kind of mosey up and kind of just grab something, kind of walk off, you know, nonchalantly. We always got good swag, so, you know, they come by. And he said, hey, Cliff, are you coming to the bar luncheon today? I said, well, you know, Mike, I usually don't do that. I just work the booth when I come over there. And I said, you know, I just want to come over and do my part. And I appreciate it, but no, I usually don't go to that. He goes, well, he said, hey, I'd like for you to come this year. I'll have a ticket waiting for you. Says, okay, I'll come. So I go tell Lori, I go, hey, Mike called me and he's got a ticket for me to come to the luncheon day. I don't know what that's all about. She said, well, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Just go see what it's about. It's okay. And so I went to the bar luncheon. In Oklahoma, the president of our bar association, they have some privileges. And one of those privileges, they give two awards every year for the Distinguished Service Award. It's a profession I talk bad about. These are the people that I ran down, not to their face, worse, behind their back. Because I'm chicken, coward. And Mike gets up and he starts talking about this guy, and I'm thinking, God, that guy's, he's all right. Wonder who the hell it is. And he calls my name. And he gives me the President Award for Distinguished Service for the Lawyers of the State of Oklahoma. Because apparently they think it's a big deal that you get in your car, you drive 400 miles to go see somebody. See, we just think that's Tuesday. Mm-hmm. But they think that's a big deal. And I was embarrassed. I got to be honest with you, at first I was embarrassed. Because they're recognizing me for something I know that you people count on me to do for fun and for free. And I'm embarrassed. I mean, I go and I thank him. He starts crying. I start crying. The damn audience starts crying. Because I don't think I deserve it. I don't think I deserve that. I just do what you guys told me to do. I don't want to do that, but the old man made me do it, you know. And what I've discovered from all that, it doesn't matter about what I think, feel, or believe. I have to take actions contrary to that. And sometimes I have to be told and directed what to do. I was about to the time I started getting back to work, I had one little deal that I'd kind of hung on to that has settled, and I made a little money on it. And I told Don, I go, hey, I got this deal, it's settled. I'm going to take Lori and the kids on a vacation. Of course, I'm going to. No. And he said, do you really think that's what the money's for? And I said, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. You know, Lori's been paying all those bills and keeping up my child support. She deserves it. You know, she deserves me to take her on a vacation. He's like, okay, whatever. I grew up in this little town in southeast Oklahoma. I told you my story about my folks didn't let me play football. My mom and dad, I grew up on a 160-acre working cattle ranch, farm ranch, whichever impresses you people the most. That's where I was. That's it. That's where I was, buddy. And they also had a liquor store and a beer to go. And when my friends were out, junior, senior year, when my friends were out, football games and that stuff, I had to work every weekend, every night. And they never paid me for that. Now, they gave me a vehicle drive, gas money, they clothed me, they fed me, they pretty much gave everyone, but they didn't pay me for that. And one of my jobs was to count the beer money at 10 o'clock at night when we closed. So I paid myself. Seemed fair. $5 here, $10 there. And I got this money and I got a plan. And my mom and dad had been, my dad had tried to talk to me once.
Right.
Okay, good. And he had tried to talk to me once, but he didn't know what to say to me. Tried to tell me a story about an uncle of mine. And, you know, I couldn't hear it. Couldn't hear it. I knew my dad loved him. My sponsor had started making me call my parents every week when I got sober. There would be times, and I'm sure that I'm no different than anybody here, they would call me on those answering machines. Remember when we had those? The light would be blinking. You knew not to answer those for sure, right? Answering machines, and I wouldn't call them back. And they wouldn't hear from me for weeks or months at a time. And they don't know if I'm alive, dead, in jail. They don't know what's up with me. And every time I would go to see them, I would see them for like an hour, and then I'd disappear for the weekend. And I'm drunk and high all weekend. And Donna had me to start calling them, and I began to build and forge back a relationship with my mom and my dad. And I'm telling you, all my life, I believed my dad was the enemy. I mean, he was a guy that all he ever did was stay married to the same woman for 56 years, get up and go to work every day, provided for a family, two boys and his wife, went and served his country with distinction in Korea, came home from the war, finished college, got a job. I didn't want to be nothing like him, man. I didn't want nothing about that. Nothing like that. And he's the enemy in my eyes. And all that man ever wanted was something better for me than he had it. That's all he ever wanted. But I saw it as he was the enemy. He wouldn't let me go the things that I want to do. There's the truth. And I can see that today, but at the time I can't see it because I'm selfish and self-centered. So I just start making the calls, building a relationship on a weekly basis, trying to just, and sometimes the calls are awkward. How you doing? Good. Okay. Well, all right, I'll call you next week. Thanks. You know, and just like that, it starts. And then we begin to ask questions. And so this money's coming in, and I swear it was the day it came in, I got a phone call from this kid from this little town 15 miles north from where my mom and dad lived. And he'd got sober in Oklahoma City and went back home. And he said, hey, Cliff, we started this speaker meeting down here in Antlers. And he said, we're going to have our first potluck the Saturday, 2 weeks later. And we'll know if you'd be willing to come down here and be our first speaker. And suddenly I knew what the money was for. So I called my mom and dad, said, I'm coming. And see, if you put a name on the list, O'Keefe used to talk about this. You put a name on the list, God becomes in charge of the list. You can arrange it however you want to. The right nows, the maybes, the nos, and when hell's freezing over. But you're no longer responsible for the list. God becomes in charge of the list. And God decides when that all works out. You just put a name on the list. And I called and I said, I'm coming home. And I was afraid because every time I went home, I got drunk. But God made me a path. A safe path. That I had an AA business to attend to, an AA commitment to go to, and it was a safe path. And so I went down on a Friday night. I drove down. I took a copy of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat my mom and dad down, and I told them who I was and what I was. And I gave them a copy of that big book. And I'm going to tell you, my dad read that book, and he loved you people. He never came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He never got to meet any of you. But he loves you because you gave him his son back. And, you know, I told him about the money. I told him about what I stole. And I said, I don't know exactly how much, but I think it's this much. Best I can calculate with interest, I think it's this much. And I had a lot of cash, man. I said, I think it's about this much. And I took it out. My mom said, now listen, you don't have to do that. And there was that split second where I thought, because I'm alcoholic and I'm selfish and self-centered. And I said, Mom, you know, I don't care if you spend this on your grandkids. I don't care if you go buy a new car with it. I don't care what you do, but it's my responsibility to get the schedule straight. And I got to get the balance sheet balanced. And this is what I think it is. And they accepted that and all was good. And everything changed in that relationship. Come to find out it was never them, that it was always me. My perceptions. And my dad and I began to have this relationship where it was always combative, cloaked in silence, you know, defensive posture always. You know, suddenly I began to call him every week and every day. And I called my dad, began to call him every day. And the conversations changed. And at the end of the conversations began this. Don said, you need to start telling me love him. Which was uncomfortable. Uncomfortable. And I don't really know, because I can't really remember. I got to be honest. I don't know if my dad ever came to me and said, I love you. I just don't remember. But I can tell you when those phone calls started, he started saying that to me. And we started to tell each other that we loved each other. And I was sitting on his back porch when I was down. Lori and I were down visiting him. And I was sitting on his back porch. It was on a Sunday morning. And we're in a porch swing they had on the back. And we're looking out over the ranch that we had. My dad, by this time, he's 72 or 3. His health has really gotten bad. He's on a walker. He had had a hip replacement. I'd gone down and spent a week with him when he was in the hospital and helped him. Doing all the things that he did for me when I was a kid, right? He can't get out of bed. He's got to go to the bathroom. I got to hold everything, right? But that's okay. I was trained because when I was a kid, I was doing that stuff, right? I'm good now, right? He wiped my butt. I wiped his. I'm cool with that, you know, because why? Because that's what we do. That's because I heard you say that. I'm in meetings of alcoholics. I heard your demonstrations of what you did for your parents. I heard that. I knew my time was, it was just my time. Just my time. And I did that with gratitude. Now, I remember my dad and I were on that back porch. It's probably 3 years after I made my amends to him. And we're on that porch swing. And it's in silence. We're just sitting. We're just sitting. We're able to sit together in comfortable silence with each other. It's beautiful, really. No negativism, no posturing, no combativeness, just together. And just out of the blue, he says this. In that porch swing, on that beautiful summer morning, he says, you know what? Daddy's never been as proud of a son.
as I am of you.
It didn't matter all the other things I'd done, all the other accolades that I had tried to achieve, 30-man law firm, all that stuff. None of that mattered. In that moment, sober, he was as proud of me as he ever was. I'll never forget that day. That night, Lori and I were getting ready to leave the next morning. He was on his walker and he went back to his bedroom and he brought in his 1955 Oklahoma A&M class ring. And he said, I want to give this to you while I can still remember. That class ring was the last link he had to his mother. His mother worked overtime in a little JCPenney store in Hugo so she could afford to buy him that ring when he graduated. And he wanted to make sure I had it. About a year later, he called me. He said, I'm going to Dallas. I'm having some heart problems. I'm going to go to Dallas. Will you come spend the weekend with me? I said, it'd be an honor and a privilege. And so I left early from Oklahoma City, and I went to Dallas. And I went to Dallas, and it was raining, February, just raining really bad, unusual for that time of year. But just rained on me all the way down there. It was raining in Dallas. It was cold and rainy. February in Texas. And my dad was bedridden by this point. Couldn't get out. And I went down there and spent the evening with him, went to my hotel room. The next basketball season, of course, February, basketball season, we're in conference play. Basketball was my dad's favorite sport, too. He is 5'4". He's a point guard. He was an animal. I mean, he was an animal. He was a really good basketball player. And if God himself had come down to me and said, hey, Cliff, I'm gonna do you a solid, brother. You tell me the day you want. Just you script it up. You give me the day you want with your dad. I'm going to make it exactly that. I'd have screwed it up, man. I'd have screwed it up. See, growing up, what I want is my dad to come out and do what I see other kids do. They want him to throw the ball with me. I want him to go do stuff with me. I want to have that, you know, Ward June Cleaver kind of deal. You know, I have this fantasy about what it should look like to be my dad. I've assigned him a role. I don't even know I've assigned him, but I realized I'd assigned my mom and dad roles. What it needed to look like to be my parents, and they never measured up. Never measured up to that. I hated them for that. I hated them for it, man. But I'm going to tell you, on that day, my dad couldn't get out of bed, and he and I sat there, and we watched basketball all day long, college ball. We watched it all day long, and we had real conversations, all day long. And he says to me, you know, it's getting late, and I can tell he's uncomfortable. And I said, you know, Dad, I'm going to go home, going to go to the hotel. I'll be back here in the morning. Don't worry about it. I'll see you in the morning. I'll be here about 8:30, 9 o'clock. He said, yeah, don't worry about it. I'll see you in the morning. I reached down and kissed him on his forehead, said, I love you. And he said, I love you too. Still raining in Texas. Haven't had dinner. I pull out of the hospital parking lot. There's a taco something across the street. And I go to that taco something. And I go in. There's a line because it's raining, but nobody inside. I'm impatient. I park and go inside. I'm not waiting in that line. Instant gratification, right? The trouble is that it takes too long. That's the problem. And so I go in and I order. And I give the guy a $20 bill. I go get my soda. Let me tell you about Don one more thing. Don was a third edition big book guy. When I would call Don with the problem of the day early in my sobriety, he would say, have you read page 449? And I would say no, and he would hang up on me. Which was an indication I should probably read that. You know? Then I would call him, he'd say, have you read it? I would say yes. He said, what's the problem? And I would say, well, there really probably isn't one, but I'll tell you anyway. And he was big on that acceptance stuff, you know, 417 for you fourth edition cats. So I go get my drink and I come back and the little guy behind the counter says, here's your change, sir. Here's your order number 449. And I think, isn't that cute? Right? Don's got spies everywhere, man. Right? Let me tell you one of the most, I believe this for me. You don't have to believe it, but I believe it. One of the most important things in Alcoholics Anonymous when you hear is because you're becoming, the book says, we've now entered the world of the Spirit. Entered the world of the Spirit. It says we enter that world when we begin to set right with our fellows. We've come through the process. So the very first time we put a name on this, we're beginning that process. We're in the world of the Spirit. When we're in the world of the Spirit, this is what I tell you. You got to pay attention. You pay attention here. I don't know if it's going to be the guy in the meeting, the gal in the meeting, or the guy at the taco shop handing me the acceptance. And I went back to my hotel room, ate my tacos, went to bed at 4 in the morning. The hospital called me and said, we found your dad. And you need to get here. He's unresponsive. They missed the DNR. They brought him back, but he was gone. And I got there, and my dad was gone then. They had him alive. He was gone. And I got on the phone to my sponsor, and I called him, and I said, I don't know what to do. He said, just be with your dad. That's all you have to do is be with your dad. And if you got to call me every 30 minutes, call me every 30 minutes. You know. And I called my wife, and she was at a conference. She said, do you want me to leave and come to Texas? I said, no, I'm going to be all right. I called my mom and my brother, and they came and they showed up. And about 10 o'clock, I got to be with my dad and hold his hand as he moved to the next room. One of the most spiritual moments of my entire life. And at his service, there were 30 people from Alcoholics Anonymous that showed up. And I'm not talking about just not from Oklahoma City. There were people from Tulsa, from Lawton, where my Fort Sill people, from Lawton, from all around the state that showed up, that never knew my dad, never met him. They just showed up. About 10 years later, my mom died. There were 60 people from Alcoholics Anonymous showed up. They drove 3 hours to a funeral for a lady they did not know. They never met her, never knew her. And they showed up at that funeral home. And I remember my niece coming up to me, and I was standing with about 5 or 6 of the guys I sponsored were handing with me. And she walked up and she said, you know, if I just had 4 or 5 friends like my uncle has, if I just had 4 or 5, and you know, if I'd have died the day before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, Lori would have had to hire 6 people to carry me out. She'd have had to hire 6 people to carry me out. If you're here today and you're sitting on the men's, if you're here today and you've got a list of people and you're thinking, no, I can't do that, I'm going to tell you something. It's the launching pad for people like that. And the question still remains, as it was the first time I looked at the step 9, is how free do you want to be? How free do you want to be? About 6 years ago, Lori and I got remarried in the church. I remember when I went in to do my paperwork, because I had one of everything. When I had to go get my annulments, I had one of everything. I've been married 3 times. And I remember after we got done, the priest says, well, this has been a great annulment workshop. I had everything, man. Everything. And it was the bottom of my list. I made an institutional amends to the church to get right with them. And Lori's and my marriage were blessed in the church. The priest said, well, hey, you want to do it now? She said, I'm not having 2 dates. Going to have it on my wedding anniversary. So we had to wait like 5 months. But on June 26, 2017, we got our marriage blessed in the church, and I hit the bottom of my list. It took me 16 years to get through my list. And the crazy part was, the priest that married me, or that blessed our wedding, member of my home group. Because that guy started coming to my home group, and I started thinking, I still have stuff on my list. You put people on your list, put names, what institutions, God becomes in charge of the list. How free do you want to be? I don't walk out of buildings today and look both ways to see who's coming. I don't have any fear about that anymore. It's like suddenly being able to answer the phone and not look and see who's calling, just answer the phone. I can't tell you your shoe color anymore, but I can tell you your eye color. How free do you want to be? Thanks, guys.